Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Set foot in any grocery store, and you're likely finding produce from around the world, regardless of the season. But according to research, 90% of calories consumed by humans now come from only 15 different species. And that's dangerous, according to my guest today. He says we need to eat a more varied diet, more in season, and more local, lest our staples get wiped out. This hour On Point, our food and our future. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you expect that banana for your cereal year-round? Have you counted how few foods make up the bulk of our diet? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Raleigh, North Carolina, via Skype is Rob Dunn, professor of applied ecology at North Carolina State University, also professor in the Center for Macroecology, Evolution, and Climate at the Danish Natural History Museum, and author of the new book, Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Rob Dunn, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Tom. I appreciate it.
I was just blown away right on the first page of your book, thinking about comparing our diets with those. You say that 13,000 years ago, that's a long time, but you say our ancestors consumed hundreds of different kinds of plants and animals in a week. They ate what could be found. Hundreds of different, and then I eat pretty healthily these days, or try to, and I fall so far short of hundreds of different plants and animals in a given week. What were they doing that had them eating everything under the sun?
Well, so they were, living out in nature. And so, on the trail home from whatever they were doing, they would pick a couple of berries. They would eat something different the next day. They would eat what was in season. And, I think that the numbers of how many things an individual community might eat through the year are pretty amazing. But in some ways, what's more amazing is that those things would have been different in one community relative to the one next door. And so if you panned out to think about the whole world, all these different communities were eating different things and knew about different plants and animals. And I think there's an argument for some groups of plants and animals that we might have known more 12,000, 13,000 years ago than we know today.
I mean,
Tom.
In some ways, you say that in those days, if you knew what someone was eating for dinner, you could probably figure out what time of year it was and where that person was living. Not, you write, anymore.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you looked at somebody's plate, you could figure out, what was in fruit, what was their local geography, were they near a river, were they not near a river? But today, if I look at your plate of food, I know very little about where you're living.
The flip side, or the modern face of this, is so different that you say the world food, the bulk of our calories, where it comes from, has never been less diverse than it is today. And these incredible numbers, 80% of calories consumed by humans now coming from just 12 species, 90% from just 15 species. That's pretty mind-blowing compared to hundreds in every given week.
It is, and I think we get a little bit deceived. If you go into the grocery store and you look at the fruit and veggie section, you do see a lot of things. But if you really think about where most of your plant-based calories come from, for most people, it's not that fruit and veggie section. It's actually when you round that corner and you get into the processed foods. And those boxes of processed foods really come from very, very few kinds of things. And it's, now increasingly the same in Turkey and Denmark and Raleigh, North Carolina. And so there's this global homogenization. And on the one hand, that has benefits. There are fewer people going hungry than at any other moment in modern history. But on the other hand, I'm at heart a community ecologist. I study how species interact. And if we think about where this food is coming from, we've created these vast ecosystems of individual varieties of crops. And there's never been anything like that, not just in human history, but really in the evolutionary history. It's a pretty unique moment.
vast ecosystems of just a few crops. And I guess that's where the risk comes in. You say look back over history. When you get a kind of monoculture or just a handful of crops or one kind of, you name it, corn or potato or banana, that then is vulnerable to being wiped out on a very large scale.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the fun things, dark in some ways, things about writing this book, is that as I turned to my colleagues who work in agricultural fields or plant pathologists or entomologists, they knew many, many stories of these main crops that we depend on and their failures across the last several hundred years that I think are sort of common knowledge in those fields, but not part of the way we think about our food. And if you take the example of bananas, bananas are this amazing thing, right? Like you go to the store and they always look the same. And part of the reason they always look the same 50, 60 years ago is that virtually every banana in the Americas being farmed was of one variety called the Gros Michel.
Mm-hmm.
And for ag, this was great because you could farm the same thing again and again. It always looked the same. It always grew the same. It was wonderful for its predictability. But it also meant it was incredibly susceptible if anything ever showed up that could kill it. You know, it's like because bananas are clonal, the banana at one end of a field in Honduras was more closely related to a banana in Ecuador than are the skin cells in your toe to the skin cells on your head.
That's amazing. And presumably most of this being, the plantations of the United Fruit Company in Central America, the big American company that had so many banana plantations going.
Yeah, and so it's a big industrial complex that became part of our daily breakfast, and they did a great job of marketing this to us. So you can find advertisements from this time period of, you know, a banana wrapped in ham, it'll make your kids healthy, and it's easy to laugh, but at the same time, you know, this vast empire of bananas was so incredibly susceptible, and it wouldn't have taken thinking about it very much to realize this susceptibility. And eventually what was inevitable happened. The pathogen that was first known as the Panama disease showed up. And when it did, it wiped out bananas from one end of the Americas to the other. And so the banana companies then had to scramble to find something else that they could grow, and found something that vaguely looked like that Gros Michel banana called the Cavendish, and pulled one over on us because it doesn't taste as good. It looks a little bit different. But the lesson we should learn in that moment is, maybe planting one clonal variety of something across a vast area has some problems. But instead, we did the exact opposite. What the banana companies did was they planted the Cavendish at exactly the same enormous scale. And so when you buy an average banana, that sort of stereotypical banana that, you know, is the kind of thing that you hold up to your ear and use as a phone. I don't know if kids do that anymore now that we have cell phones, but it's all that same banana. It now is at the same kind of risk as the Gros Michel was. And so we repeat this story in virtually every kind of agriculture that we do, and we don't seem very good at learning the lesson.
You remind us of whole landscapes going black when the Panama disease finally arrived, hit that cloned banana. One valley in Honduras alone, 30,000 acres infected and abandoned within the first year of the Panama disease arriving. I mean, when they sing, yes, we have no bananas, it's because in that old song, it's because there was a moment where they didn't. They were just gone.
It really was. And we still haven't solved that problem. So that if you tried to plant a Gros Michel banana on those fields today, it wouldn't grow. The pathogen is still there.
And it's not just bananas. I mean, you've had other examples of this, many you write about, but coffee, the English in Sri Lanka, before tea was such a big deal, it was coffee, it was hugely popular, and then it was gone.
That's right. I mean, it's our modern story. You know, that we plant a really simple thing, the pathogens either evolve or catch up and wipe it out. And in a way, it's a story that repeats so often that it feels like, do we need to go through this again? And yet we are living through it again and again. Chocolate's in big trouble. Rubber's in big trouble.
And what about the food mainstays that we count on in those supermarkets? Corn, wheat, soybeans. Are they invulnerable?
They're differently vulnerable. And so many of those crops, particularly corn and soy, are largely transgenic in the U.S. now and in Brazil and other places. And so rather than depending on, say, an individual gene native to that plant to defend themselves, we've added new genes into those plants that allow them to defend themselves. And so what's happening there now is not that some pest or pathogen that from the native range of corn or soy is catching up, but instead pests and pathogens that are able to evolve the ability to eat those plants and get around those defenses face a vast ecosystem that they can consume. And so now it's not just a race to keep things from catching us geographically. It's an evolutionary race, which we're also often losing.
And of course, so there's that evolutionary race, and then there's just the simple fact of eating out of season and how you say it's kind of a key to the mindset that makes us vulnerable.
That's right. I mean, it connects us globally in a really big network, all dependent on the same things. And aspects of that aren't going to change. You know, it's a big ship with lots of inertia, so we're not going to suddenly change our global food system tomorrow. At the same time, there are lots of things that we can do individually in terms of our choices that improve the food system in ways that give it more stability.
We're talking about how our hunger to eat everything, anything, any time of year could end up threatening our food supply itself with Rob Dunn. His new book is Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Behind me right now, Billy Jones' version of Yes, We Have No Bananas got tied to the banana shortage caused by the Gros Michel banana blight, known as Panama disease. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
We have no bananas today. Just try those coconuts, those walnuts, and donuts. There ain't many nuts like they. We'll sell you two kinds of red herring, dark brown and ball bearing. But yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about how our hunger to eat everything, anything, any time of year could end up threatening our food supply itself with Rob Dunn, professor of applied ecology, North Carolina State, author of the new book, Never Out of Season. You can join us this hour. Do you try to eat more seasonally? What does that look like? Is going locavore the solution? If it's locally grown, it's automatically in season in a way. And can you see the risk factors that come into play when we eat a few foods or eat foods any time of year and expect it to be that way, never mind the season? Rob Dunn callers for you already aplenty. Glenn in Browns Valley, Minnesota. Glenn, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Boy, quite a conversation here. What I was wanting to talk about a little bit was that as a child, I grew up on a reservation, and as children, we used to eat continuously off of the prairies and out of the wooded areas and things like that. We'd eat different things, like starting with June berries and all sorts of berries, like wild grapes and choke cherries, plums, and all the like. But we also ate different herbs that we would find on the ground, and we called them sheep showers.
Mm-hmm.
What the real term for them were.
This was this a Native American community that you grew up in, Glenn?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, yes, it was. But I wasn't focusing on the Native American side, but
okay.
I was mainly focusing on what is out there that we used to be able to eat. Wild tea. We used to suck on tea leaves, wild tea.
Yeah.
And a lot of different types of things that are not growing anymore because of all the pesticides and stuff that are sprayed, or herbicides, and a lot of these things are just gone, and they're very rare. And that's the same way with the supermarket. It seems like back then when we'd grow sweet corn, we used to be able to save kernels off of the sweet corn mm-hmm. for next year's plants. And then nowadays, seem like they just won't germinate like they should.
Glenn, stand by. Rob Dunn, it's interesting. Glenn doesn't make much of the fact that it was a Native American reservation where he was growing up. But you actually do point to indigenous peoples as important markers or examples for us and the way they have eaten and how much of it's been lost.
Yeah. I mean, I Glenn, thanks for sharing your story. I really appreciate it. So, I mean, if we think back to the way that people ate historically around the world, indigenous peoples, which would have included all of our ancestors somewhere, right? Figured out ways to rely on many of the species around them and to have many kinds of knowledge about those species. And, you know, often, and so in and of itself, that knowledge has incredible value, as do those traditional ways of using the plants around you. And if we think back to what our grandparents did and knew, for many of us, it was a richer experience of that natural world. And that knowledge has personal value, but it also has incredible value as we think about the future. And so if you think about, for example, the story of rubber, right now, if you kick the sidewall on your car tire, that sidewall is all natural rubber. Mm-hmm. And virtually all of the rubber in the world is grown in tropical Asia. And all of that rubber is susceptible to a leaf blight that's what wiped out every plantation anybody's tried to grow in the tropical Americas. And what we're going to need to resolve that problem, if that leaf blight ever shows up, and really it should be preemptive, is knowledge about the different varieties of rubber. Well, we know that many varieties of rubber grow places where indigenous peoples have tremendous knowledge of those plants and how to use them for different things. And so that's a case example where right now, if we were to engage those communities, we would learn more than we know scientifically, or in terms of Western science. And so I think there's both this incredible heritage and human value to the richness of those experiences, but there's also this great value in saving us from ourselves. Because every time we have one of these major problems of a new pest or pathogen, we've got to find a solution somewhere. And often those solutions come from nature and people who know about that nature, you know, be they indigenous peoples, scientists, or just somebody living on the land.
Glenn in Minnesota, remind us of another thing or two that you miss from those days when you would wander and pluck.
The thing that I missed a lot is there was a plant, and I've never been able to find even a picture of it that we used to like to, as children, we used to like to pull the whole root up. And then we'd clean it, you know, just wipe the dirt off, and
yep.
We'd break the root off and then chew it. And what it was like, it was kind of like a mentholatum or like on the order of a cough drop or something.
Yeah.
And if we were having throat problems, we would do that. And it would, and I've never been able to find it anywhere. It has like a brown, picky center, kind of a reddish brown, and it had leaves that appeared like possible feathers.
Wow.
But they stuck out all the way around it. And I've never been able to find anything like that. And everybody we talk to, we can't seem to find those anymore.
It sounds like a dream for a kid, just kicking along in an afternoon, and right there's your mentholatum tree just pulled right out of the ground. Glenn, I really appreciate your call from Bronze Valley, Minnesota there. Rubdon, take us back to this eating out of season habit that is now pretty deeply ingrained in an awful lot of people, and how you make the connection from that to trouble, potential trouble, eating out of season to potential trouble.
Well, I mean, eating out of season means that we tend to eat the same things year round, which is just another aspect of the simplification of what we eat. And so we're always eating these very few things, regardless of season and geography. And so if any of those gets into trouble, it really threatens not just, you know, individual people or communities, but it has global repercussions. And so yeah, I think that's the real problem. At the same time, I mean, I don't imagine we're going to fundamentally change what the average plate looks like. But if we can change a little bit about what that plate looks like and encourage more local consumption, encourage more local diversity of crops, even if we shift that a little bit, it continues to allow people to have experiences like Glenn's, which are sort of going extinct, you know, that kind mm-hmm. of specific relationship to that plant. And so you don't have, that doesn't have to become your mainstay to still be important to you personally. And by the same token, it doesn't have to become the average crop to still be important to our ability to find solutions when we need them. You know, it may be that It's hard to say that that plant that Glenn was talking about with the feathery leaves. I mean, it sounded really wonderful and magical. What solution does that plant offer to the problems we face in the future? Unless somebody's paying attention to it and knows where it is, it's hard to even know where to begin with answering that question. But if we still have an eye on it, if somebody's still eating it, if somebody still knows a little bit about it, it's at least partially in our world of understanding, so we can go to it if we do need it. And so that's where if you're able to eat more local foods, if you have connections to farmers markets, you don't have to imagine that you need to change your entire life to still have a big impact on what's out there. And I think that's especially true for crops that are diverse in your particular region. And so I live in North Carolina, and we have a great diversity of okra, of squashes, even of some heritage corn that are found nowhere else. And so if I can eat a little bit more of that diversity of things that are sort of from our region, I increase the odds that somebody still knows a little bit more about them, that some farmer has an incentive to plant them a little more. Mm-hmm. Even if I know I'm going to, feed my kids with pancakes from the standard grain that everybody else is buying on some particular Tuesday.
Oh, I'm so crazy for okra. Let's go on an okra tour sometime. So part of this is quality of life. It's in that a more varied and interesting diet. But part of this is about life itself and threats to it. I mean, you're making some big warnings here. What's the nightmare scenario that you have that can or could flow out of this concentration on a few species?
So, I mean, I think that there are different sorts of nightmare scenarios. I mean, one of them is to think about particular regions. And so, we think about the banana story, and it seems kind of frivolous. Well, I lose bananas. I can put something else in my cereal. But it's not a frivolous story for those people growing the bananas or those people working on the banana plantations who face really direct consequences if the Cavendish banana fails. And by the same token, if we look to Syria today, many things have conspired to create the situation we see in Syria. But one of them is certainly a prolonged drought accompanied by an agricultural shift in Syria before the drought toward more intensive agriculture, more dependent on irrigation, and more dependent on varieties of crops that were not from that region. Mm-hmm. When that drought hit Syria, there was a collapse of agriculture, especially in those places where it had to be irrigated. People moved to the city. There were already lots of Iraqis, refugees in the city. And it led to a great deal of unrest in those increasingly large and hungry urban populations. Now, there are many other things that could have happened in that story that would have led us to a different moment. Mm-hmm. And yet it seems very clear that the simplification of agriculture and the need to keep agriculture either ahead of pests and pathogens or climate change, drought, was a big part of that story. And so on the one hand, will corn fail in the U.S. in a way that makes us all hungry? That seems like not the most likely kind of next 30 years story. But can a particular wheat fail in a region like Syria in a way that has global consequences? That seems like a very likely kind of story.
Mm. Get another call here from Jim in Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air with Rob Dunn.
Hi, Tom. I live in corn country. You get just a few miles out of town and you begin to see the millions of acres of cornfields. So we have very little diversity here, but, we feed the world. And I can't really imagine anything that could destroy those millions of acres of cornfields except possibly drought. And drought makes you think of climate change. And I'm wondering if climate change is a factor in what you're talking about here.
Rob?
Yeah, that's a great question. So with agriculture, we've always had to keep ahead of changes in the world. And those changes in the world have included, fungi, things called oomycetes, beetles, but they've also included changes in climate. And we know we're facing massive changes in climate in many regions. And the varieties of crops we're farming today in most places are not going to be the ones that are best adapted to the next climates we'll be dealing with. And so in that light, we are going to need new kinds of crops for those new climates. And so one way to keep ahead with those new climates is to imagine somebody in some scientific building with shining lights and lab coats and gloves, breeding the new variety or engineering the new variety that will get planted when the variety that you see out there fails in new climates. And that's a possible scenario, but it means we're really, really dependent on somebody typically now in one of very few companies to keep ahead of that changing climate on our behalf. The other model is that we have planted in those regions multiple varieties now, so that as climate changes, that there's always at least one variety out there that's going to do better in that next climate. And I think that ends up being really important, especially in those regions where we can predict the long-term average climate, but we might not be able to predict what's going on next year.
Is that happening, the multiple breeds in the fields?
In some places. So in Canada, for example, there's an effort to do this with forestry, where there are forests being planted with many varieties of trees in the interest of hoping that one of those varieties will do well in whatever the next climate looks like. And there are lots of scientists working on new varieties that will do well in a general sense. But those fields with many varieties, it's not happening at big scales. And some of the problems are technical. You know, it's harder to run a tractor through things that are different heights. But it benefits us a lot. And so even if each community just has a few fields that are planted in another one of those varieties that might be useful, it still helps us in the next step. But it's a great question. Thank you for that.
The next climate, there's a phrase. Diane in Appleton, Wisconsin. Diane, you're on with Rob Dunn.
Hi, great conversation. My question is actually twofold. First of all, in an area like Wisconsin, very few crops can be cultivated here. And of course, we're going to be buying avocados from California and oranges from Florida. So are we referring to crops that are just going to be able to be grown in our own state? And also, does this give validity to the whole aspect of GMO?
What do you mean by give validity to GMO? What do you mean by that?
Well, if we're talking about a possibility of, you know, blight or that type of thing, of course, the whole aspect of genetically modified is to make a hardier crop, so we're not going to have a shortage, or, you know, it's going to be more oblivious to any circumstances with climate and that.
Yep, got it. Rob, how about it? I mean, first, you know, Diane in Wisconsin wants to know if you're saying that she's going to, if she wants to do right, she's going to eat what grows in Wisconsin in every season, and that's it.
Yeah, so I'm not going to suddenly start eating, you know, when I'm in Denmark in the summers, only those things that grow through the Danish winter.
Pretty narrow diet there.
Yeah, pretty narrow diet. Or I mean, I'm going to Iceland soon, right? And for as much as I enjoy a fermented seal, that's a hard thing year round. And so I think what the caller can do is to eat more of those varieties that aren't native to Wisconsin. And as Glenn pointed out, there are many more of those than we tend to think. And so, you know, there are local farmers markets that are farming, providing local crops. And so to the extent that you can do a little more makes a big difference. I'll still eat avocados, right? They're a pretty lovely, rich thing, but I'll do it with the awareness that, you know, I'm always making choices that have a global impact on agriculture. What this all looks like in different regions is going to be different. If we think about, in some of the most important places for us to think about eating locally are those places with lots and lots of heritage varieties. And so, for example, Mexico, with an extraordinary diversity of heritage varieties of crops on which, you know, we've depended again and again through time, it's really important that there are good markets for those heritage varieties. And there's some great things happening in Mexico today. And so, for example, in Merida, there are markets that farm only local varieties of crop, provide only local varieties.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how our hunger to eat everything, anything, any time of year could end up threatening our food supply itself. Rob Dunn is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Never Out of Season, and you hear how he sees the world. What do you think? Do you see how year-round availability and big dependence on just a few foods could create an Achilles heel for our food supply? How do you change the habits that may point us in that direction? It's out there already. I mean, here's from a couple of years ago. CBS News spoke with the researcher Ekmini Obok, who spends his time studying cocoa's deadliest viruses like frosty pod rot and swollen shoot virus. Here's the outlook.
If you really want to continue enjoying chocolate and the chocolate product and produce, you should care about what I'm doing, else at some point you're going to run out of your chocolate. Depending on the strain of the virus, you could have a total crop loss ranging from 50 to 100%.
Total crop loss, 50 to 100%. And that's just chocolate, you might say. But here's agriculturalist Kerry Fowler, gave a TED Talk a little while back warning of the effects of climate change and might have on crop diversity and food supply.
By 2030, if the maize or corn varieties, which is the dominant crop, 50% of the nutrition in southern Africa, are still in the field in 2030, we'll have a 30% decrease in production of maize because of the climate change already in 2030. 30% decrease of production in the context of increasing population, that's a food crisis. It's global in nature. We will watch children starve to death on TV.
That's a prediction Rob Dunn writes about, reminds us of what has happened repeatedly in the past. Humans are vulnerable to this. Rob, take us back to the Irish potato famine. And I mean, people think they know the story, but you tell it very vividly and the lessons we might draw from it even today.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty wild story. So the potato is not native to Europe. It's an Andean crop, and it's one of these things that conquistadors brought back, which fascinates me in and of itself because we trusted a bunch of stinky conquistadors to choose our food for us. But so they bring it back. It makes it to the Canary Islands. A bunch of varieties are farmed in the Canary Islands, but one of those, called the Lumper, makes it to Northern Europe and grows incredibly well. And people figure out that they can get most of their nutrition from the potato on its own. And so families start to farm potatoes, and especially if supplemented with a little bit of milk, it actually provides complete nutrition. And so in different parts of Northern Europe, the political and economic framework led people to depend more or less on the potato. But in parts of Ireland, the dependence was near complete. And so people were eating tens of potatoes per person a day, and that was basically it. And it was great. The Irish looked healthy and were, all commentators said they didn't have clothes necessarily, but they were tall and healthy and fertile. And then the predictable happens. A pathogen called the potato murrain, originally, we now call it late blight, shows up in New York, and then it shows up in continental Europe. And it sweeps potato field to potato field and just wipes them out, turns them black. And this is before we really understand germ theory. And so although this is happening, people at the same time are having to figure out what a pathogen is. And so it's a bad time to have to figure out something so central. And so what everybody says is, well, at least it's not in Ireland. And then it makes its way to Ireland. And the first year, it's devastating. It devastates the Irish crop.
What year are we talking here?
Oh, I'm going to miss the years.
1840-something.
Yeah, 1840-something. Mm-hmm. And so in that first year, devastation, but everybody's hopeful that the next year will be better. The next year is worse. The year after that is even worse. And so thousands and then tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands die. More people emigrate. And so the movement of Irish to Boston to New England is part of the story. Mm-hmm. And it all relates to this funky little blight that at the time was thought to be a fungus. We now know it's an Oomycete. And nobody really resolved what caused all of this until decades later. And so, you know, even in the 1880s, people were still leaving Ireland. And in and of itself, it's a pretty terrible story. It's a sort of inconceivably terrible story, but it's extra terrible in as much as there were indications of how to control this early in the famine. But nobody sort of agreed, and no one listened to the scientists who understood what was going on. And so instead, it would take until the 1880s before control measures were even partial.
The Irish potato famine, 1845 to 1849. And you describe how early on the blight was identified by biologists. They called it Botrytis devastatrix, signaling that they could see how devastating it could be, but they were ignored. Do you feel that our massive industrial agriculture system is listening and responding to these warnings, these concerns today, Rob?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think that many biologists working with individual crops know about these stories. They know about the potential problems. But the system is not necessarily designed in such a way as to hear the stories and the problems and to deal with them. And we put far less attention on understanding pests and pathogens of crops than you might imagine. And so, for example, we know where, you know, every bird species on Earth, we can make a very detailed map of where that bird species lives and even where it's more abundant, where it's less abundant. There is nothing comparable for the pests and pathogens of our crops. There is no global public access database of where each one of the things that might, you know, wrench corn out of the ground lives. And so in some really central ways, we've kind of failed to do what we need to do to be prepared for the next potato blight or the next one of any of these kinds of problems. And the flip side is, you know, in many of these moments, what saves us is some other species, some beneficial species that eats the pathogen or the pest, or some set of genes that we become really important for breeding. And we don't have good maps of where those live either, nor do we have their... You know, we have zoos where we keep monkeys, but there's not a zoo of all of the, you know, the parasites that we might use to control pests. And so in some pretty central way, we're grasping at the edge of what is knowable. And all of that unknown is still out there lurking over the next hill.
And you don't know what may show up to save you or not show up to save you. Here's a little clip from National Geographic explaining how a South American wasp helped save Africa from a cassava plant or manioc plant decimated by mealybugs in the 1970s.
Scientists looked to South America for a natural enemy of the mealybug. They found a special parasitoid wasp and introduced it in Africa. But how could a wasp save the day? While a mealybug is sucking sap from cassava leaves, a female wasp swoops in and lays its eggs in the mealybug. When the eggs hatch, the wasp larvae eat the mealybug from the inside out, killing it. The new wasps soon mature, and the process starts over again.
Nice guitar music there, but the dependence on the cassava for food was overwhelming. Look at our dependence on just a few crops today and how we eat them. I eat them, many of them year-round. Rob Dunn's new book is Never Out of Season. He warns of fallout from that. Marianne is calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Marianne, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to just mention something that I guess I'm doing here in La Crosse, which is just joining a CSA, a community-supported agriculture.
Yeah.
We're a member of a small family farm and really feel that supports not only the family farm and having more of them in our area, but also it requires us to try new vegetables that do grow locally in season. We do share recipes. We cook more. We value our meal time. And just think there's a ton of benefits by actually joining a CSA, being a member of a local farm. And the county south of us, I live in La Crosse, Wisconsin, south of us is Vernon County, and that county is actually home to the most organic farms in any county in the U.S., and we have a farmer's market, we have a community garden, we have farm-to-school programs, we have the GROW program, which gets kids in the school gardens, growing school gardens,
yep,
growing things. teaching them that. And we also are very close to Seed Savers, and we have a seed library in our public library to try to just continue the preservation and the sharing of seeds. And I just, lastly, I guess I just also feel that food cooperatives, being a member of your local co-op, is also a great way to impact regional food sharing for small family farms and foods that grow as close to you as possible when it's not something that you can readily get right in your town.
Marianne, I love all of that. I mean, part of what you're pointing to there is just set up the systems or participate in the systems that are there that encourage leaning in that direction, and it sounds terrific. Let me get one more here. Glenn in Boston. Glenn, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Rob. I think it's a really fantastic subject. I think it's something that's very current as well, because we live in a society where now increasingly local and fresh is becoming more important, with caterers that provide farm-to-table, they say, service. I actually am in the food industry. I own a local bakery here in Boston. And, in getting local and fresh ingredients is very important. Growing up in rural Maine, I never really thought anything of it. We grew our own fruits and vegetables. We lived on 65 acres of land. We could pick fresh blackberries and blueberries in the summer. And that's when we ate them. And I grew up with a mother that believed in, you know, having fresh food that wasn't full of preservatives. And then moving away in my 20s, I kind of got used to buying asparagus in the winter, buying asparagus, mm-hmm. And other things, artichokes in the summer instead of just in the spring. And then afterwards, living in Italy kind of brought it full circle again, where food is really important and it is like a foodie's paradise, but you would never eat anything out of season. I asked for a certain kind of artichoke dish in the winter, and they looked at me like I had two heads. And then it was like a light going on.
Yeah.
And, in thinking, this is how we should eat. And now we're just so accustomed to buying everything all the time. I think not only in terms of how we're going to deplete our resources, but also in true health in our manners of eating, I think it's affecting us gravely.
Glenn, that's a great story all the way through. I'm still back there picking the berries on 65 acres. Of course, not everybody can do that, but there has been a change. There's been a change in our expectations, and I appreciate your call. One more. You did it in Maine as a kid. Let's go to Maine right now, Garland, Maine. Michael, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. And thank you. Your guest has really brought up some important points that I don't think about much, but we do. And a lot of my neighbors grow a lot of our own food up here. And I wonder if your guest wants to piggyback on, and the last caller too, talk about what models, what economic models of production and distribution, and then the mass marketing that might go with that, and that's been done so successfully by agribusiness. What new models is he thinking might ameliorate this, might broaden our diversity,
Yeah, Michael, I think we've got it, and it's a great question. And if I may, our time goes a little short here. Let me put it to Rob Dunn. I think that's just the right question. Rob, what about it? New economic models of production and distribution that might tilt things the way you're advising.
Yes. So, I mean, these are wonderful calls. I'm sitting here super hungry now after the last couple. So I think that, one of the immediate kinds of answers is the kinds of things that Marianne, if I get her name right, was mm-hmm. talking about, that these community supported agricultural models that are embedded in the community. But I think the bigger answer is that these sorts of things also need to be embedded in national policy. That offers support for those sorts of community agriculture projects. And there are certainly countries that have moved more in that direction. The new Nordic food cuisine movement has lots of national level support in the Scandinavian countries that make it easier for those local community farmers to be represented in stores and to engage communities. I think
how do they do that, Rob? How do they do that? Just to get to the nitty gritty.
Well, I mean, to put it the most direct way, I mean, we have agricultural policies that support those really big companies, yeah. Right? That we're set up to make life easier for them. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of wonderful scientists in those companies trying to help us move into the future. But at the same time, we putting all of our eggs in their baskets and depending on them to keep ahead of pest pathogens and climate change for us seems misguided. I would say the other part, to go to a different part of that question too, is that I really like this sentiment that I think is really important, that we can all engage not only the consumption of crops, but the farming of them, the awareness of what's around us that we can eat, and the ability to get kids outside, reconnected with nature, but also reconnected with food, because we've really lost that, as some of the callers have mentioned, and that's a really important part of any kind of economic model that's going to sustain local agriculture, is enough awareness in kids of where the food comes from. And so we're working a lot on how do we get kids to plant crops at home, at schools, but also to help us study what's challenges those crops face. So there's a lot ahead of us. We won't get to it all today, but boy, I appreciate these calls.
Do you think we'll scale up to the challenge? What's the most important step that we might take to do it?
There are different steps nationally and individually. The steps individually have to do with what you buy and, you know, what you plant and eat. The steps nationally have to do with implementing policy that slow down this race with pest pathogens and climate change, that introduce policies that allow us to better mitigate the evolution of pests. And I'll close there, but thank you so much.
Rob Dunn. Really interesting, taking us through the history and right into our own present with its implications for the future. And I'm struck by how robustly people respond to this, have responded already to this, many in their individual lives. That race with the bigger structures of our economic model around agriculture, we shall see. Rob Dunn's new book is Never Out of Season, How Having the Food We Want When We Want It Threatens Our Food Supply and Our Future. Professor at North Carolina State University, and he's at the Danish Natural History Museum both. Rob Dunn, thank you very much for being with us today. Listeners, thanks for all your input. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.